Up next on the program, happy to welcome back to the show historian, author, professor at the University of Maine, author of several books, including 6 Minutes in Berlin. Happy to welcome Michael Sokolow back to the program. Michael, thanks for being with us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Sure.
A lot of things going on, but let's talk about an event that you're going to be part of soon, coming up on June 18th, the World Affairs Council of Maine and the Maine Fulbright Association collaborating on Celebration of the Legacy of Cultural Exchanges, a storytelling event. Tell us more about it, if you can.
Yeah, it's an event that, it's too bad. It was going to be in person in Portland, and it's the World Affairs Council of Maine and the Fulbright Association, and it's inviting people from Maine who've gone abroad to work in whatever their jobs are, and or who bring people from abroad to Maine to talk about what it means to have these kind of international exchanges. So there's a social studies teacher from Freeport. There's a town manager of Amherst, New Hampshire, is going to be there. There's a environmental scientist from University of New England. I'm going to be talking a little bit just what it's like to work abroad and what it's like to bring people from abroad to work in Maine.
Well, of course, you had the experience of being in Australia earlier. What was that like for you, and how did that change your perspective, if at all?
Oh, it was great. It was great for me, but it was really and We each, in this event next Thursday, we're each going to talk a little bit about the experience in general, not just the work. And for me, it was really about bringing my wife and kids to see a different culture and learn about that culture, but also learn about the United States from abroad. You know, I think that's one of the biggest issues that we really face right now with all our polarization and everything, is a lot of Americans don't quite understand what's going on abroad or how the rest of the world looks at us.
Well, that's certainly the case. We've become isolationist in many ways, including, I guess, when it comes to self-awareness. And there are possibilities for people, as you mentioned, regardless of your position, your walk of life, the opportunities to travel abroad or out there through the Fulbright scholarships.
Yeah, and I should say, I want to point out, the event is to encourage people to talk about the experience, but there's going to be representatives from the State Department and the Fulbright who are going to kick it off and say, hey, if you live and work in Maine and you might want to think about doing what you do in Maine somewhere else, here are your options, here are your opportunities.
And for more information, people can contact the World Affairs Council of Maine, wacmaine.org, to RSVP by the 17th. And it's open to the public and absolutely free. You can't do much better than that.
Great.
All right, let's talk about some other things going on in the world. We're in the midst of the most bizarre presidential campaign, if not in history, certainly in a long time. And depending on what polls you're looking at, Joe Biden may have a double-digit lead. I don't know what that means at this point, but it seems that the strategy for the Biden campaign so far has been for him to lay low and let Trump do most of the heavy lifting for him.
Yeah, I think it's shrewd. I think it's brilliant. I don't know if you've heard the expression, hide a Biden. That's what they're calling it. He's literally hiding. He's picking his spots. He's counterpunching. I think, by the way, I don't think he's the one who's coming up with this. I think he has a very shrewd campaign. But, if you think about the relative opportunity cost of going out there, perhaps making a gaffe, I don't know if you saw it, but Brad Parscale, the guy who runs Trump's campaign, has written a letter to CNN saying, they are not showing enough Biden, that they need to cover Biden's events from start to finish, and it's causing a problem for the American people. And this is because they're so desperate to get Biden to make some kind of gaffe. So I think this is all indicative. And, I mean, the other thing that shows that it's working is the gap is growing. Biden's lead is widening.
Well, how can – obviously, any gaffe, I would guess, is a bad one, but – the voting public has, or at least his supporters, have ignored all of Trump's gaffes and misstatements and outright lies. So how much damage can a couple of errors do to the Biden campaign?
See, it's interesting to me that you say that, because that does make sense. That's perfectly rational, right? Except we live in a completely irrational media world where if Biden accidentally says something, the framing of him as being mentally incompetent or having dementia or whatever the framing is, that the Trump people would then grab onto and amplify using bots and trolls and all kinds of things, and blow out of proportion would be dangerous, I'm saying to the campaign relatively. And so I think they kind of understand this, and I agree. It looks like he's avoiding it. It looks like he's not taking this leadership position. But the flip side of this is sort of the opportunity cost. It's very clear that President Trump wants to change the conversation desperately, and a Biden gaffe would allow him to.
And the Trump campaign, rather than try and widen the net, expand the umbrella, and get more people aboard, is just seemingly doubling down on energizing the base, and they believe that's the path to victory, but that path only includes, what, 25-30% of the electorate?
Well, it's fascinating, the rally question. I mean, do you think, let me ask you a question, Rich. Do you think there's really going to be a rally next Friday, the 19th, in Tulsa? I mean, it's astonishing to me.
Yeah, I don't know what will happen there because I think, first of all, I think there'll be some pressure on the city of Tulsa not to do this, given the date and the circumstances. And now that we've seen publicly that the campaign has sent out a waiver to people signing away their life to participate, you have to wonder how many even rabid Trump supporters would show up.
Well, you know, and Trump came to Maine's 2nd Congressional District, where you and I are. Trump came here 4 times in 2016. So if the rallies start up, he's coming back up here. So what do you think would happen if he comes to Bangor?
Oh, I think people will show up. I mean, we saw that to a certain extent last week when he came up to Guilford. I think it's so interesting to me, and this will be the subject of several great history books, of how the response to the pandemic in this country has fallen almost completely along party lines.
Yeah, and one thing that has me quite concerned that came out yesterday. So we now have 3 conclusive studies on masks, one from the USS Theodore Roosevelt, one from the United Kingdom, and one from Germany, and they're unequivocal. There's statistical significance that the masks work, that they inhibit transmission. And in the German study, which was by far the most rigorous, they inhibited transmission more than frequent hand washing or social distancing.
Right.
So this shouldn't be political anymore, you know. And so the question is, the government is now armed with a level of science it didn't have just 2 weeks ago about masking. And so I'm very curious how the U.S. government's going to handle this.
We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. In the media world, of all the things that Tucker Carlson has said and done through the years, and we've talked about how Fox may not have quite the influence that we think because of the number of nightly viewers they have, but now, finally, sponsors are dropping out of this show. I guess my question would be, what took so long, and will this do serious damage to either Carlson or Fox News?
Okay, the first thing, the answer to the second part is no, it will not, because Fox News gets between 66 and 70% of its revenue from cable subscription bundles. It gets about 30% of its revenue from advertising. So Tucker Carlson has been boycotted significantly. If you remember when he said the immigrants were dirty, he lost far more advertisers than he's lost in this current wave. And so I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the structure of the media economics of cable television, Fox is going to stick with him. But the bigger question about Tucker Carlson that I keep coming back to is, we used to live in a media universe where Carlson's show had a liberal across from it. Remember Crossfire with Podesta?
Right. Now
we live in a media universe where he spews out for an hour with nobody opposite him. We used to live in a media universe where Hannity had a guy named Combs to check him. Or, you know, there was Point Counterpoint on 60 Minutes. There was the way the op-ed page used to be framed. There used to be tons of space in the media. It used to be accepted and expected that there'd be common disputation. And I always think it's stunning to me that Carlson was on a show where he was checked, then Jon Stewart blew him out of the water, and now we live in a world with no Jon Stewart and Carlson not being checked.
Yeah, and all of this ties into what's gone on with the New York Times. They took a great deal of criticism for running the op-ed from Senator Tom Cotton, and you know, you've got connections to the New York Times through the years. They've made a change in their op-ed editor, But what's the role, this is more of a general picture, should the role of newspapers be to present all opposing views, any opposing views, even if in the case of Cotton's, they're based in fiction and untruth?
Exactly. We got to be careful, because when we use the term newspaper, there's the journalistic side, the reportorial side, and then there's the editorial side, which is where the opinion columns are.
Right.
I want to only mention the opinion side. And, you know, I like the interplay of ideas on a good, robust opinion page. I think it's very useful. I mean, if you think about ideas that you may disagree with, if you make them to a certain extent, I'm not saying you have to endorse them, but if you make them beyond the pale of rational debate and discussion, interchange, exchange, toleration, it's not like they disappear. You're the one closing your eyes and not being able to engage. And then it shows up in the voting booth with a surprise vote, you know, like with Brexit or Trump, or it exists. So my take on this question of what should be on that op-ed page, what should be in the marketplace of ideas, it should be as robust and as vibrant and as reflective of the society we live in as possible without specific endorsement. I mean, that's the problem that they ran into with the Cotton one. You have to make it very clear to your readers that we are publishing this because this is a perspective that's relevant and has a following in the United States, and then publish a counterpoint to it, too.
It seems to me that when I was growing up, and obviously the media world was very different then, but I knew the difference if I was watching the news. I knew that Walter Cronkite was delivering the news and Eric Sevride was delivering his opinion. If I read the newspaper, I knew that the op-ed page was not all about facts. It was about opinion, whether it was from the editorial staff or from people who wrote letters to the editor. But somewhere along the way, consumers seem to have lost that understanding, and I don't want to point the finger just at Fox News, but how did we get to this point where the lines have become so blurred, particularly in television media?
Well, I think it's really complicated because I think it involves our education system. It involves the way we teach media literacy and social studies and questions like that, but it's also the commercial world fraying. People who didn't like Huntley or Brinkley in that world would still have to tune in because you only had three channels. And I just think, I actually think it's really only about 10 to 15 years. I mean, Crossfire, the McLaughlin Group on PBS, all of these debate shows, Hannity and Combs, they were on the air 10 or 15 years ago. So I kind of think the biggest thing that made this world evaporate was social media, was the idea that we can now block out ideas, opinions that we find distasteful, that we find disturbing. And by the way, I should say, we don't have to actively block it out. We're monitored by Facebook and Twitter, and our timelines are curated. So I don't want to make it sound like we're all choosing this. The social media companies are choosing it for us.
This is going to be such an unusual presidential campaign. It already has been. Do you think we see debates this year between the two candidates?
Wow. Well, if we do, they're virtual. But that's a great question. I'm curious what do you think we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know for any number of reasons, and a big one is I don't believe that Trump wants to debate. Now, I could be wrong in that, but again, I think, or the people around him, I should clarify, don't want him to debate because of the possibility of those very same gaffes we talked about in regard to Joe Biden. I don't know what'll happen.
No, I actually think, now that you've mentioned it that way, Trump is 100% confident he will beat Biden. He is, if you think about the way he talks about Biden, Sleepy Joe, and all this. So I actually think if he remains behind, he's going to very much push for the debates. The question would be, if Biden still has a 10-point lead in September, October, why would he agree to it?
Right. For him, there's nothing to be gained. It's like when your lead is that big, it's like Division I teams playing a D2 team. All you can do is lose. Even if you win, sometimes it's a loss.
People seem to forget that there were no debates from 60 to 76, and the only reason they came back was Ford was trailing Carter, and he kind of thought he could do a Hail Mary at the end, and it worked. He gained a little bit, but it rebounded against him. People who were worried that Carter wouldn't appear presidential enough liked Carter in the debate. So sometimes these kind of equations don't work out the way they think.
And I don't know that we've talked about this with you on the air, but you've written about it wonderfully. The very first televised debate, 1960, with Kennedy and Nixon, owed a great deal of its format to the game shows of that time period.
Right. And, you know, we're still, unfortunately, we're still living with that, because the guy who invented the television debate, and just so you know, they were always officially called joint live press conferences. They refused to be called debates by the Democratic and Republican Party in the planning stages, because neither wanted to allow the candidates to question each other. I mean, it sounds nutty, but that's what they were really afraid of. Just like today, there's no way Trump and Biden would agree that the two of them question each other, because it's too risky. And so they needed a format everybody would agree on, and it was one with a genial host, you know, a live audience, questions that were rapid-fire, be answered in a minute or two, and the quiz shows provided the model.
Well, interesting times indeed. We appreciate you helping make a little sense of it here this afternoon, Michael. Thanks for checking in with us. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Sure. Thanks again.